Hi, folks. Welcome to another episode of Film Study. We're here to talk today about the defense against the Broncos. And joining me, our friend from across the pond, James Ogden. James, how you doing?
Not bad, Ken. How are you?
No complaints at all. We've had you on at least once this summer. I forget exactly what the topic was. It must have been that good. No, I'm just kidding. But I've forgotten the exact topic, but it was good. And that's why you're back here doing a regular defense show.
Yeah, it was my defensive assists work that we talked about when I came on last time. So I'm very, very happy to be back on to talk defense this week.
All right. Now, before we get too far into this, make sure people know what your Twitter handle is.
Yeah, my Twitter's at NFL Ogden. And you can find me on my own site on Red Star Baltimore. And I write for Russell Street Report as well.
Okay. All right. Outstanding, James.
Oh, Ken, I should also get in that I'm also on the UK Ravens podcast. So the guys would kill me if I didn't get that plug.
I was thinking that might be the case. You know, it just, we got this tweet that says, you know, he's one of us is finally on the show kind of thing. Yes, they would hate that. Okay. So finally a dominant defensive win after the first 3 weeks where the Ravens had constraining factors. They had injuries really against Detroit, held them back a very, very shallow front five. And then 2 weeks before that, they had the kind of quarterback that probably gives them the most trouble, these quick release guys with Mahomes in week two and Carr in week one.
Absolutely. And I felt like the Lions game was just a lesson, really, that you can't go into an NFL game against even opposition of that caliber, probably one of the worst teams in the league, although they are playing everyone pretty hard this year. You can't really go into that kind of game with losing, not having, you know, most of your, pretty much all of your defensive line, and still expect to win at a canter like you would in ordinary circumstances.
Yeah, the Lions really leaned on the Ravens in that game too. I mean, they knew what the Ravens' weakness was, and they went right after them with six offensive linemen on a number of plays and a number of their heavy formations with a lot of tight ends and a fullback, and they knew how to go after them. And I agree. I mean, you know, NFL teams are NFL teams. They're all pretty good, and scheme matters, and who you have available certainly matters.
It surely does. They attacked us very well. I think they also knew that, you know, we do struggle with let's say dynamic running backs out of the backfield, and they utilized Swift really well. We took Hockenson out, but there was took Hockenson out much more effectively than we'd taken Kelce and Waller out. But it was at the expense of giving up a lot of place to Swift,
right? And that really exposed the inside linebacker weakness. And I guess that's you'd expect that inside linebacker weakness to show up more in a game where your front five was really compromised, because you know those inside linebackers, they have to make plays, whether it's a run or the pass rush not getting home. They need to protect the middle of the field more in those terms. And Goff in that second half really picked him apart, honestly, in terms of how he attacked those linebackers. We're going to get to a little more inside linebacker stuff here, but one of the things that made the Broncos a little bit easier of an opponent, I thought, was the fact that they really do not vary their offense much. And, you know, we saw a fullback, not at all. We saw no sixth offensive lineman. We saw exactly one running back on every play, that's fairly normal in the NFL. And we saw 1.34 tight ends per play. So they had 82 on 59, I think it was. So it was a set of 11, 12, and 13 personnel packages. They never went 22 or 23 or anything crazy with 10 personnel.
No, and this is, that's really a Pat Shurmur offense, isn't it? It's it's very. I always remember the story about how. The Washington owner, is it Snyder? Dan Snyder, went into Mike Nolan's dressing room after a game and said after a game had in Mike Nolan's office, had left some vanilla ice cream for him and told him he didn't like vanilla play calling. Where he wouldn't have liked Pat Shurmur particularly too much. But Pat Shurmur, I think, you know, he's been an offensive coordinator, play caller for over a decade, so he does something right. But one of the things that is a hallmark of his offense is that, you know, they run the ball and they run play action, and it's you know, it's pretty simple. You just got to stop it. There's not a lot of smoke and mirrors to it in the same way that we've seen in you know, we've obviously played some, especially with the Chiefs, you know, we played some very, very interesting exotic offenses over the last few games.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Ravens, in fact, this, despite the fact you're always facing 11, you know, there are some fans out there, I think you'd say you can't really rotate your personnel as easily because you have to have your same packages on front. Well, that's not really true, because the NFL, you have so much ability to rotate through the very most standard packages, and the nickel is the base now in the NFL for just about every team. So they didn't really overwork anybody in this game, which I'm happy to see for a change. 59 total snaps. Campbell had 40. Bowser and Oway among the outside linebackers had 42. That's good rotation, good Ravens rotation to those players.
Yeah, and I felt that was, I mean, it was probably out of necessity the last few games, but you know, we've seen the Ravens go away from that slightly the last few games and play some heavy snap counts for some guys. But I was really interested to see, and then I you know, going back to the tape, we're recording here on Monday night, so we don't have the all 22 yet, but I did you know, I've been back and watched the broadcast a few times in prep for tonight, and so seeing it was, you could see on tape, I think, why, but, you know, we were Madubuike, Washington, those guys, Brandon Williams' snap count was pretty low for our Ravens defense. So they kept those guys on the, Campbell, Oway, Houston on the field quite a lot. I was interested to see that.
Yeah, so Campbell still got a fair amount of snaps in this game, but you know, he had been, before he came to the Ravens, he'd played between 77% and 80% of his team's snaps for five consecutive years. So it's an overworking of a guy his age, and it's amazing to me the productivity he has playing 40 snaps in a game. I thought, you know, one of the things that'd be really great about going to the Ravens is he'd play less, and he has. He's played a lot less, but he greatly increases productivity for him. I think we've seen that increased productivity this year more than last year, where he was playing hurt when he was playing.
Yeah, and I think the challenge for the Ravens is that I think one of the underrated aspects of defense of that you need in defensive line play is mental processing. Like you have to understand what blocks are coming from where and how to deconstruct them. Yeah. And experience is no substitute in that phase of play. So I think the not having Derek Wolfe through the start of the season has been a big reason why Calais is playing so many snaps, because you just Wolfe and Campbell on the field together is great, but also if you can get at least one of them on the field, you've at least got a guy who understands how to deconstruct those blocks, and you could see Brandon Williams is great at that too, but it's a slightly different role that he plays. So when you see Madubuike, I feel that's, you know, that's one of the, I'm sure we'll get into it, but I feel like that's one of the areas for his development still, in the run game, recognizing blocks, where they're coming from, and how he's going to deconstruct those. So I think that's why Campbell's had a high snap count for me, just because of the absence of Wolfe.
Yeah, that's one of the things you always hear is just how complicated it is for defensive tackles to play the run.
Yeah.
And particularly two-gapping defensive tackles. That won't be a problem for Madubuike, because he's a one-gap penetrator, but you know, will be something that he needs to improve his learning on. I'm so impressed with where Madubuike right now is in his ability to win one-on-one pass rush situations. Yeah. It's hard to be upset with him for any shortcomings in the run game. Let's move on a little bit. I thought, you know, one of the things that really stood out about this game, and the Ravens obviously played a very tough physical game, and I talked about that a little bit in the article. I'm not going to get into that on the show here because I think it's not as useful. But the complementary pass rush and coverage was really something in this game. I mean, you know, I look for certain clues, but you always see when the quarterback holds the ball for 5 seconds and he gets sacked anyway, and they say, oh, it's a coverage sack. Well, yeah, obviously, but there's a lot of clues that you can look for to see when pass rush and coverage are playing nice with each other, are really helping each other out. And, you know, you see balls thrown away, for example. By the way, toss in any when you think of them, James. But, you know, one of the things is cornerbacks really going step by step with receivers up the sideline and using the boundary well. To me, that's a technique that does a very good job of providing the pass rush time to get home. And when you usually see that ball thrown, it's usually out of bounds.
Yeah, and I feel like Sorry, I always dive straight into players. I feel like Averett did a really good job in this game. In what could have been a real mismatch for him with Sutton and Patrick, but he, as you said, he used the boundary really well. And I just couldn't agree more with you that the way that the Ravens played this week in terms of that complementary pass rush and coverage was great. It was back to what we expect, I think.
We always let ourselves get diverted when we can here, but Patrick and Cortland Sutton, enormous receivers. Mm. And beyond that, they use tight ends, Albert O and Fant. I mean, they had so much size on the Ravens, and they never really were able to press that advantage in any meaningful way. I mean, those guys, they got a lot of targets. Those four guys ended up, I think, with 24, 25 targets, something like that for the game, but it was ended up maybe 26 for 143 yards. So 5.5 yards per target, just that's not going to do it. That's not when your best players are doing that.
No, and I can hear people in my ear. I think we got a little lucky that with Drew Lock playing in the second half, it was a different offense, and he was missing guys, and he also wasn't able to. You saw flashes in the. Teddy didn't have a great game, but you saw flashes in the first half where he was able to read where the blitz was coming from and get it to a guy like Sutton or Patrick, Patrick mostly in the first half, who was using his body well to make catches. And we got a bit lucky with Locke, who was quite inaccurate in the second half and certainly didn't have the same kind of brain to be able to pick off our blitz packages. Although Wink dialed up, the exotic rating on the blitz packages went up as the game went on.
We need to talk about this a little later, because I'm not sure I agree with that statement.
Oh, okay. Okay.
We'll talk through it a little bit. It certainly is everybody's observation from the game is this is a real complex blitz package, but I got a few numbers to share to that end.
Cool. That'd be great.
The other things I just want to tell people, my thoughts about other things to look for to see that pass rush and coverage are complementing each other. One is look for the defender to become the receiver. When that happens, it's usually a case of that play has gone on for a while. There's been a chance to look back and track that football by the defender, usually a good sign. Pressure that throws off screen timing. Diagnosis that forces those screens to be grounded. That's great complementary play. Hands in the air to prevent easy and hot reads. Quick tackling when they get completed anyway, because a lot of those are going to get completed anyway. But have your linebackers and safeties make quick tackles, and that's pass rush and coverage working together. I named a whole bunch more in the article, and I've got a barking dog now, so I'm gonna leave it at that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think one of the guys, I don't know if we'll get into it. I'm not sure if we'll get into it, but I one of the guys who, I put a tweet out about him. I do think was great in terms of the completions happening and getting tackles made was Chuck Clark, who is just turning into a really, really highly competent safety who uses his mental processing to increase his play speed and takes just great angles to the football. So I felt like he was a big, he often gets sort of taken for granted a little bit. I think, he signed a deal. No, but I think some fans do, don't they? And he signed a good deal. So it's kind of like, oh, he's banked. He's there. He's going to just play well every game. And actually, you got to call out when he has really, you got to call out those guys when they have really good games. And I thought he had a really great game on Sunday.
Yeah. A great game against the Lions too. One of the things, I think they're actually losing some value from Clark by having to play him on the back end. And they split that duty a little bit with Stevens, but Clark is taking a lot of back end responsibility. Jimmy Smith had some too, I guess, but Clark's taking a lot, and he's really an outstanding dime back if they could get their safeties aligned, because being in the middle of that defense and being able to cover for some of the inside linebacker weakness we'd have, it's just an enormous potential value of Clark. We saw that last week when he led the team in tackles. And he was in the middle of that defense, knowing what's going on. There's almost no player on that defense right now. And maybe Elway, maybe Humphrey, who if you lost him, it would be more significant. Maybe Campbell, but none of them would really be any significantly more of a loss than Clark, who holds that defense together right now.
couldn't agree more with you. I think you know, I'm sure we'll get into Owe and the pressures, but he, you know, that I feel like the Chuck Clark is just. I think you're right. I think they are struggling to, not struggling. They are not getting the best out of him because of where they're playing him. I wonder whether that was some of the thought process behind the Stevens pick, to try and get something else back there. Although that, I suppose that could also be about Elliott being out of contract too. But
I think the hope was that Brandon Stevens would be the free safety of the future. The problem is he's so damn versatile. They've used him all over the place. And so, you know, they want to make him a, this is preseason really, but they make him a slot corner or make him an outside corner even. But he's, I hope he improves in some areas, tackling, recognition, where he hasn't been so great at the NFL level. And I think that'll naturally come with experience.
Yeah, I think so too.
All right. What else do we want to talk about in this one? The tackling and pursuit issues. I mean, I hate to keep bringing this up every week because I really don't want to have this show just become a bash Patrick Queen fest. We spent probably 20 minutes talking about it last week. Unfortunately, had another terrible game. And, you know, really four tackles that were a big problem. Even though he didn't get a missed tackle on the play, I was incredibly frustrated by the 31-yard run by Williams. And all of the things that went wrong on that play.
Yeah, I've got like a bunch of notes on that play, which sort of says that. There was a bunch of things that went wrong. I don't actually think it was Queen's worst play of the day. you know, what I felt you saw on there was actually you had. A couple of guys playing their assignment. You had Owe setting the edge. You had Campbell controlling the point of attack. And then not a lot else, really. You know, Tavon Young reads it really well, but then the whiff is pretty bad. It's not a whiff that's a helpful whiff that we've talked about before, where
didn't turn the running back or change his track in any direction.
Yeah. No, it was great that he saw it and he got there, but there was nothing there. And then it was one of the plays where I was a bit concerned about Anthony Averett. If you pause the play, you can actually see him sort of rock back on his heels as if he's sort of saying, I'm not sure I want to get involved with Javonte Williams here. Mm-hmm. So I was a little disappointed that he didn't sort of stick his nose in there. And then you've got it was a catalog of got like Bowser's on skates.
Bowser's a mess, yeah. Stevens gets steamrolled.
Stevens, I think it was Stevens and was it Stevens and Bowser? I think you couldn't combine for the tackle. And it was almost like there was a lot of focus on the fact, because Marlon Humphrey said afterwards that he couldn't believe he got dragged for 30 yards, but I'm not actually sure Marlon was the worst culprit on that play.
I you know, honestly, the fact that Marlon hung on saved the touchdown.
Yeah.
So I like that. I Anthony Averett probably deserved a missed tackle on the play, possibly for not just sticking his nose in there, but that would be just kind of a judgment missed tackle you'd be assigning. But I thought he didn't get a good angle from behind the play, and then he kind of jumped on Marlon's back more than he jumped on Williams and fell off the play, which probably was fortunate because he could have dragged Humphrey off of Williams the way he attacked from directly behind. I really, you know, one of the things that really strikes me is Justin Ellis got pancaked at the line of scrimmage. He was on his ass. He had to get up and run to that play. He got there at the same time as Queen did. Okay, there's a whole bunch of other guys, Clark, Tavon Young, who were down behind the play. I mean, they did not catch up either. I mean, it's not just Queen. What looked bad about what Queen and Ellis did is that they were side running, you know, running parallel to the play, and each of them had a point where they slowed down, and then the tackle didn't get made. They had to speed up again. I mean, just, you know, get in there, and finally Owe, you know, saved the day and made the play there, and temporarily only, they still scored on that one, but annoying play.
Yeah, and I think it was Ellis getting put on his butt was a microcosm of, I think, of the, I'm not going to give Queen and Harrison a big pass for this game, because I do think there were many issues. But one of the things I would sort of temper with this game was that I felt it was a strange game for the defensive line in terms of occupying double teams. I felt that the Broncos schemed up pretty well in the run game to create good angles on on Brandon Williams and others on that defensive line and Madubuike, where they created down blocks and easy blocks for those three. Well, specifically for Muti and Quinn Meinertz, who are obviously making their debuts. No, Muti's played a bit already. So I think that to me was part of the story as well for Queen and Harrison, that, you know, they were not running free. They were targeting Queen, and, you know, Queen has to be better. He has to read his keys better. He has to understand that teams are going, like, he has a weakness that he cannot get off bigger blockers when they have a run at him. So he has to understand that that is a weakness of his game, and he has to improve his processing to be able to beat those blocks before they get there. And he has to understand that teams are going to use jet motion. They're going to use things to distract him, to give him eye candy, to set him up as vulnerable to a second level blocker. And the Broncos, I felt, did that really well. And they combined it not just by getting to Queen and setting up and doing all that smoke and mirrors. Well, not all that smoke and mirrors. They didn't do a lot of smoke and mirrors, but a little bit of smoke and mirrors to isolate Queen. And I also felt like our defensive line didn't help out. I think that's part of the story, but probably not the main part of the story.
Yeah, you're giving Shermer's offense a lot of credit with their consistent 11 personnel of being able to confuse Queen. But honestly, Queen has looked very confused, and not getting off blocks has been a consistent issue. You know, you mentioned a good thing when you say process faster and avoid the block. But there's another element. He's got to use his length better. And he doesn't have exceptionally long arms, but that's where you go to the old defensive line tenet that one arm's longer than two. And I know they don't always teach linebackers to do that, because you want to kind of two-gap a blocker coming at you so you can go either way to get to where the running back is going. But you got to have some ability to commit one way. The other thing I really haven't seen from his is gap commitment. And one of the plays that really showed it up is one where he wasn't on the field. So Josh Bynes was on the field for four straight plays, and I think it might have been the first one or maybe the second. There was a run right for 10 yards. Bynes, you know, the good news, Bynes evaluated what was going on, diagnosed it, got in the backfield, got to the ankles of the player. It was a diving attempt. I noticed that PFF charged him with a missed tackle on this. I don't think I would. I mean, I think it's too tough for a diving play is not generally where you want to toss in a missed tackle lightly. And he just didn't quite get it. But the problem is, Queen has the athleticism and the speed to make that play, but he wouldn't have had the understanding or the diagnosis skills to get there as quickly.
No, I agree. And the other thing we saw from Josh Bynes on occasion was, I think it was in that set of plays, I made a note that he kind of showed Queen how to do it in terms of getting off a bigger blocker as well. There was a point where he got off a bigger blocker and used his length, actually. I went and looked up their measurables just because I thought, am I missing something on Bynes? Is he that much bigger than Queen? And no, actually, he's not. So you're right. It's Queen learning how to deploy what he has better in terms of his speed and even his size, which isn't big, but you know, you can deploy that size better than he is doing currently.
Right. I had Queen for three missed tackles in this game, and there are, like, no doubt about it, misses. But there was another where he was outmaneuvered by Patrick in the open field for 13 yak. I mean, that was a bad play. Probably a lot of people aren't going to call that a missed tackle, but it was just a bad play. I don't want to have to say bad things about Queen every week, but I think we're at a point where he's got to take on a more limited role where he can focus on a smaller set of responsibilities and getting better at that. And unfortunately, this may make him a player who gets to be good about the time we're going to lose him. But it's the nature.
Yeah. I think the other thing that we have to remember, I don't want to make excuses for him, but I think the other thing is, you know, he is a very young player, and that was a risk we don't actually often take in the draft, where we take guys that are we usually prefer a bit more production, a bit more time as a starter. He, you know, even in his final year at LSU, he didn't grab the starting job until about 2-3 games in. So he's very experienced poor coming out of college as well as into the pros. So I think you're right. I think the career trajectory may be different than we expected. And that may be a like you say, that may be a problem for us, because it may be as we're looking to take up his option and then to potentially lose him.
Right. I mean, that's really the question, is they have to decide after year three whether they take that fifth year option. It will not be cheap, of course. It never is. And then they may have to decide he's only going to be a 4-year Raven, which will make it much more difficult to re-sign him, of course.
Yeah.
All right. Let's go on and talk some packages in this game, because there were some interesting things in what the Ravens did package-wise. Because, you know, we've noted the inside linebacker difficulties they've had, and now for several weeks we've been talking about this on this show. And yet Martindale is not changing, despite the available personnel to do so, to play more dime or more five-man fronts in passing situations, even with dime, that could give you a zero inside linebacker look. He really didn't try and do that in this game. He played, in fact, exactly two inside linebackers on every single snap.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. I wonder whether that's something to do with the defensive backfield, the challenges of the defensive backfield in terms of injuries and not wanting to press too many inexperienced guys into too big a role too quickly. But I guess the point now is that we're getting to a point where that might start to become a necessity, because you may imagine that the play from some of those more inexperienced guys in the defensive backfield actually may end up being better than what they're getting currently out of the two linebackers that they have on the field.
Yeah, I mean, I thought Harrison and Board both played pretty well in this game. Yeah, you know, but what I always say is that your third best coverage safety is almost always going to be better than your second best coverage inside linebacker, which is why the dime almost makes sense for any team. And you can talk about, oh no, we got to fit our defense to do this, and we want to have three down unicorns at both positions. It doesn't really make sense. It doesn't make organizational sense from a cap perspective, and it really doesn't make sense in terms usually of who your actual personnel are when you're being honest. I think the defensive coordinators who stick with it are guys who are afraid to get caught with their pants down on an ensuing first down against no huddle with a light lineup that they think it'll be easy to run on and get a fresh set of downs again. Dean Pease, really, I always thought that about him. Martindale has not shown that sort of fear. And I don't really understand why against Denver, you know, they went with a smaller lineup. The only thing I think is that the guys they have as receivers were so big that they really thought they needed bigger tacklers on the field in Queen and Harrison.
Yeah, that could have been part of it. You know, that was one of the things with this offense that I think you'd have been a lot more worried about this offense and the way that we would set up in terms of personnel if they'd had Judy and Hamler available, two guys who can win quickly and can win off press too. So that probably played into it with the fact that Sutton and Patrick and Fan and Okwe Ubenam, I think.
Alberto,
let's leave it at that. Yeah, definitely.
All right. Yeah, I think it's very good that the Ravens, you know, made it so that those players never imposed themselves on the game. I felt very good about that, you know, coming out. Go quickly through the packages here. Base, they played 12 times, only allowed 34 yards, 2.8 yards per play. The standard nickel, again, they went to this an awful lot, 19 plays. That included the 31-yard drag and missed tackle fest that we discussed. But, you know, otherwise it wasn't all that bad. 19 plays, 108 yards, 5.7 yards per play. That's your worst package. That's pretty good. So they played one race car nickel snap where they gave up 8 yards, and that I guess would technically be more, but who cares? They played a lot of jumbo nickel in this game. Actually, not a lot, but 5 plays. Odd package here. Don't know if you noticed it. They only had one outside linebacker on the field for 5 plays, and they used 3 defensive linemen, 2 inside linebackers, 1 outside linebacker, which is odd, and then obviously the 5 defensive backs. I think it really belongs categorized with like a jumbo nickel because of the 3 defensive linemen and 5 DBs is the oddball combination that repeated.
Yeah, and I feel like that was to negate the fact that the thing you need to sell out to stop with the Broncos is the run. Like, you have to stop the run first and foremost, otherwise you can see with Shermer's offense the way he uses run action once he's established the run, can throw people off. So, the pullers on play action, it will happen a lot. So if you don't stop the run early, so it does feel like that was predicated on that, I feel.
Now, when you say run action as opposed to play action, you're talking about pulling on a pass play?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Some people use different terms, but that's a good one.
Yeah.
Definitely something the Ravens do a lot is pull to and then pass without even going to the mesh point. They'll do it with just on any given play. Let's see, anything else to talk about? They did play a lot of rush nickel with three outside linebackers, one defensive lineman. They used that in the first half. They used it on all these obvious passing situations. Then they used it at the end of the first half. Then the second half, they used it on obvious passing situations. And then, kind of like they did with the dime in 2019, once they got the game in hand late in the fourth quarter, midway through the fourth quarter, they just went to this package every single play, that's what I like to see. I like to see them, get back in a nice, easy, obviously as early as possible. You'd like your team to be able to go into pass prevent long and just play that alone.
Yeah, I agree. And I think Oweh helps them as well with the packages as well. With the speed that he brings onto the field, it does help them. Get more defensive backs on the field in those kind of situations.
This is one of the interesting things about Oweh and what he does for you is he really gives you that same flexibility that we'll get someday. I think we'll get the same flexibility from him that we now get from Bowser. But Oweh has the luxury of adding those duties kind of on the fly as he can handle them. And not only that, he's doing a good job of learning them and handling them one at a time as he goes right now, including some of the things he's already showing about having a secondary pass rush move, being able to be a stunt under guy. That is not obvious to me. I mean, it's obvious to me he'd be a looper. It's not obvious to me he'd be a stunt under guy. But when you think about it a little bit, his length is extremely useful there. You try to cross the face of a guard, go crash into a center. And the other thing is, just like with a tackle who overreacts to anything he does, the entire offense, including the running back, overreacts to what Oweh does. Particularly we saw the Lions doing that where they had him triple teamed on one play. And Clark got the sack on that.
Yeah. I think this was one of the reasons I was most excited about him coming out of Penn State was because when you watch, I went back and watched every single snap of his college career. And when you go back and watch every single snap of his college career, what you see is a guy who hasn't played a lot of organized ball, who gets better every snap. And this was the thing. He was starting at such a low point in terms of understanding of the game, understanding of even his body, understanding his body and how he would deploy it as a pass rusher. But you saw him pick up stuff. You saw him try stuff in games. He was getting better with every snap. So I did feel like you were betting on someone who had real potential because they had that kind of development gene that he seems to have. And you can see that in these first few games, like you mentioned, it's interesting. The thing I'd like to see him do more of, because I'm a huge fan. So I'm not just jumping straight to his areas of improvement. The thing I'd like to see him do more of is I felt the tackles in this game gave up their chest quite a bit for him. I'd like to see him start converting speed to power a bit more consistently and coming through some of those tackles because they were really scared of his speed, and so they were giving up their chest pretty often. And I'd like to see him just adapt a little more in game and have a bit more of a plan in rep to what he's seeing from the offensive tackles, I think.
Yeah, he's got, because he's so athletic, he has got a broad array of possible secondary moves, possible first moves and possible second moves. But I think one of the cool things to see is going to be that it's not just one thing. It's the ability to go to length and maybe a chop. It's ability to go from length to a spin. It's the ability to do all sorts of things by taking Eurostep is a contactless version of that sort of pass rush move, which uses his athleticism. All of them, you know, are viable. And if he has two or three of the tool shed, it's not going to be fair. No. I mean, it's
really gonna be fair. Well, the thing as well on his sack was just it was on the. Did he have a? No, he only had one, didn't he? On his sat on, I'm thinking of the obvious one. It was his use of hands that was most impressive to me, because it was one thing out of college that you saw a lot of him, but was a little bit inconsistent. But the way he controlled the outside arm of the offensive tackle to be able to flatten to the quarterback, if he can continue to do that, you know, his. Like you say, it's not going to be fair, because his closing speed is ridiculous. So, you know, we also saw flashes of get off in this game as well. We saw flashes of burst from him, which I think we sort of knew he had in his locker, but he was playing run first at Penn State and he's playing run first a little bit here too. So we saw flashes of that burst, but his second and third step is scary.
Mm-hmm. He's got great motor too. Yeah. And, you know, with the Ravens coverage being what it is, with the secondary being what it is, I mean, this is an ideal place for him in terms of, you know, being able to take his time. In fact, you know, with the sack he had against the Chiefs, quarterback hit on the interception. He actually disrupted Kelsey's route to start that play, then started his pass rush. And, you know, just like any disruption by press coverage, or maybe a better example is by chip block. If a running back chips or a tight end chips, they then have a limited set of routes that they can really run. You know, they're all secondary routes. They can't really be the primary target anymore when they chip. So you have a limited set of things you can do. Well, you think the same really works for a pass rusher. If they jam a receiver as a first choice, well, that limits them as a pass rusher. And just the motor that he has and the time the Ravens can sometimes give him to operate is really, you know, McCrary 2000 level stuff. I mean, it's going to be fun to watch.
And anybody thinking that this is because he's a rookie and people are leaving him alone and not, you know, just giving him one-on-one opportunities all the time, that is not the case. He is
completely
getting chipped
focused
regularly. Even in the Raiders game, you saw it. They already came out. And that was part of the problem in terms of his sack production at Penn State, was that he was the sole focus of their of teams when they were coming in to play them. It was like, oh God, please don't let this kid ruin the game.
He probably improved Shaka Toney's draft status significantly with the amount of attention that he got there.
And Ittor Gross-Matos is the year previously
the year
as well.
Before,
actually.
Yeah. 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 The year before. Okay. So let's move on to talk about the pass rush a little bit. This, since we jumped into Owe and talked about him, we don't have to come back to it. I know you said earlier that we thought that, you know, Martindale had pretty well greased up a big plan here, but there's quite a bit here that was very limited in terms of the Ravens pass rush. I mean, they dropped back 42 times for starters. They gave up only 8 ample time and space opportunities. It's 19%. And I know you're not completely maybe familiar with these numbers as I report them, but that's significantly lower than normal. Maybe about 30% or a little higher would be about average. So really good opportunity. Most of those are in the second half, by the way, that they gave away. Bridgewater only had 2 ample time and space opportunities in the first half. So they did a really good job with him. But in terms of numbers, let's start with that. They only rushed 5+ on 15 plays. So it's 15 out of 42. Now that's a lot for the NFL, but it's not a lot for Martindale to rush 36%.
Yeah, no, that chimes with me. I think, I shouldn't have used the word exotic earlier, because I don't think this was an particularly exotic game. I think as the game wore on, I think Wink brought some slightly different pressure packages as the game wore on into the second half. But I don't think this was a particularly exotic game from him. I just think that the exotic meter on his blitzes went up slightly as the game went on. Would be a better way to put it.
That's fair enough. And it sounds like you're talking about like elements of deception, as I would count them.
Yes,
you may have others.
Yeah.
You know, there's blitzes and there's blitzes. I really hate the definition everybody uses of a blitz at 5+, because it doesn't mean thing. If you show people 5, they know how to block the 5. It's not really confusing to them. But off-ball blitzes are when a player comes, for me, more than a yard and a half off the line of scrimmage, or they come from a slot cornerback or further out. And they used only 8 of those in this game, 0.19 per pass play. That's extremely low for Wink. He did have 0 against Mahomes, by the way, but he last week against the Lions, he used at 0.36 per pass play, so double the amount of off-ball blitzes. And on those plays, Bridgewater and Locke picked them apart. And, you know, it's really hard to find any division of plays where Denver did well in this game. But when they used individual blitzes, they were 7 of 8 for 104 yards, 13 yards per play.
Yeah, and this chimes with, the data isn't a surprise to me. I think it was more Bridgewater? Because it felt like it was more Bridgewater that shredded those blitzes. I don't know whether you've got that, Ken.
I do have it. So let's see, off-ball blitzes in the first half. Queen for PR11, Harrison PL19, PL3 on a Queen, PL12, PL14. It probably was more Bridgewater.
It felt,
Six of them were against Bridgewater. There were only 2 blitzes the entire second half. They went for 13 and 32, though. So 45 yards in the second half.
Yeah, it did feel like it was Bridgewater obviously they didn't blitz lock as much, but it did feel like with Bridgewater it was the thing is, so I'm doing the preview series for a sort of Street Report this year, and so I watched a lot of Bridgewater in the lead up to this game, and he is just operating the offense. It's a West Coast offense. He's operating it very competently.
Right.
He's making his reads. He's throwing the ball on time. So I suspect Wink was a little bit wary of how good Bridgewater's been against the blitz so far this season, and it bore itself out in the first half. You know, he ID'd those blitzes really well and threw in behind them to, like I said earlier, to Tim Patrick a lot, who was using his body well to box out and make those receptions. So there was definitely that element to it. But the numbers, not a surprise to me.
All right. Stunts are another thing I look for a lot. And, you know, a lot of people think that the stunts are called by the defensive coordinator. A lot of them are actually called on field by the players. And in fact, Campbell has said in the past that, you know, he's allowed to call a stunt anytime he wants, as long as there is not a designed blitz coming on the play that it might interact with. So in the game, they stunted 9 times individually. And that's when it looked like to me there was a plan to stunt on the play. Sometimes you get a loop that's because somebody's being blocked and they'll kind of bop off it. But these look like 9 individual plans. 5 times it was 1 and 2 times it was 2 on the same play. There's an old X's and O's game called Double Twist Willie would have been the play that you'd be running if you did that. But those 7 plays with a stunt went for 7 total yards. Those included 1 sack. So that was a nice way that the Ravens got effective pressure, was by stunting as opposed to these off-ball blitzes.
Yeah, and one of the things I felt on the stunts was actually that the reason why a lot of those were successful was because the Broncos were very wary about their interior offensive line being inexperienced. So they reduced the splits right down. The running back, if he was releasing into a route, always went through the A gap to release out into the route. And he also often stayed in and was sort of predetermined to stay in and ID the middle. So they put a lot of pressure on their tackles, and I felt that was where the pressure came from on stunts. They clogged the middle a lot, and the stunts were very effective, really, in freeing up space outside.
Yeah, it's a great point that the Ravens came into this game with 2 new guards and Miners and Moody. I mean, both very impressive run blockers. But the inexperienced pass blockers at the NFL level, I mean, both of them, I think they expect them to become good players. But, you know, what was interesting about it is the Ravens really beat the tackles. They beat the tackles 1-on-1, not just bombard the A and B gaps to try and find opportunities to beat the tackles or the guards. But they did a wonderful job with both Bowser and Oway. Beating those guys silly.
Houston too as well was
yeah, good point. So last thing about deceptive pass rushes, simulated pressures. They had 10 simulated pressures in this game, and those were you know, not as effective as just doing other things with a pass, because they have 57 yards, which doesn't seem like a lot, 5.7 yards per play. But when overall they only had 3.5 yards per pass play, you got to say, well, there are other things that worked even better. So there was a 32-yard pass in there that kind of skewed the results, but otherwise it was an interesting group of plays that had a decent number of pressures and QHs, but not the best yard result.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because I think that was that the simulated pressure is probably what I was talking about in terms of dialing up the exotic nature towards mm-hmm. into the second half.
Oh yeah, I agree.
And I think that's interesting that very interesting to hear the resultant yardage from that actually.
But let's first mention Tick Pick because they're back with us today. That's TICK, PICK as in tickets pick. No need to search over the internet anymore for your Ravens tickets because Tick Pick, TICK, PICK, is the original no-fee ticket site and the only site you need for all your NFL tickets. They got rid of all those awful service fees, and they guarantee the best prices. If you find it cheaper for the same seats, they'll give you 110% of the difference price. Spence reached out this week, wanted to use the code, because he was looking to the same game I'm looking at, Thursday Night Football down in Miami. That's going to be an attractive game for Raven fans to jump on. And he went on to TickPick, used the code Ravens, and saved his $10. So head over to TickPick.com/Ravens and use the code Ravens when you check out for $10 off your tickets and the show support for Film Study.
Looking forward to that Miami game. Go be down there and see you for that, Josh. And Spencer, you too.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm looking, yep, in the fourth, 94 in the second half, four simulated pressures. For some reason, I thought I saw a bunch of simulated pressures towards the end of the game, but it's really at the end of the first half.
They did
four straight simulated pressures as well. That went well, PR3 and then three straight incompletes. So,
yeah, that drive at the end of the first half, actually, yeah, that drive was quite, that was an impressive drive, wasn't it? Because it, you know, it got, I feel like he Wink felt the urgency of that drive, knowing that if we get the ball back and double dip, knowing that we had the ball after at the mm-hmm. start of the second half, that was a key drive to get the ball back with at least a bit of time left on the clock.
Yeah, great opportunity to stick the dagger at him, that's for sure. Well, I'll tell you what, let's move to this part of the show where we just talk about individual players, and you're the guest. Please bring up one, and then we'll alternate and make comments about each.
Yeah, so the first guy I think I'd quite like to talk about is Tyus Bowser, who I'm a huge Bowser fan. Really like Bowser an awful lot. I think this was an interesting game for him. There was some great which we always get with Bowser, but there was also some of the challenges that you have with Bowser, which is when you get him in run defense against, if he's lining up on the close side of the formation against the tight end, he's fine. He'll set the edge. He knows how to use leverage really well, and keeps his pad level low and is able to control the edge and set the edge. If somebody schemes up a little bit more to attack him and gets a big body on him, he can lose out. And I wonder if that is a weakness that other teams will look to exploit into the future. That is by no way me disparaging the rest of his play, which again was very good. He's so good in coverage, and also we saw his pass rush chops in this game too, I'm in awe of the kind of the weapons he's added to his pass rush, given the deficiencies that he has in terms of size. But he's able to come through guys now and has really added a curve and a change to his sort of bread and butter speed rush. So I'm impressed with him in lots of different elements, but I just wanted to bring up that one aspect that I wonder whether teams will try and attack in the future.
Yes, it's interesting that he didn't really have all that many pass rushes in this game. And I've got he's in my star treatment section of the article this week, and he has about 11 notes about him. Probably 9 or 10 of them are good. Okay, one of them is always balanced because it's whatever I've got for notes for him. But most of them are pass rush elements because he didn't really have any coverage notes. First of all, that's a good sign if you drop to coverage a lot because it means they're not targeting him. But second of all, he did it, and I want to say he had – something like maybe 13, 14 times where he dropped the cover in this game. So it wasn't just a little. And let me try and see if I can find that here real quick. I don't think I have it right in front of me. So, but anyway, it's that's the order of magnitude. So something like, oh, there it is. 19 times he rushed the quarterback to accumulate, you know, the array of pressures that he had. And it was impressive. I thought, you know, he's good when he gets to the quarterback finishing the job, and not every Raven is good at that. Even Owe has had some difficulties with it. But he did a good job, I think on that. I worry about run defense so much less with Tyus Bowser for starters. You know, you have the down by down deployment of him. So Tyus Bowser can be a guy who plays a much greater percentage of snaps when the other team is trailing, when the other team is in more obvious passing situations, end of half, you know, all of those times when he's going to be of more use to you. And then, you know, you don't even really get the full value of what he brings to the Ravens pass rush without also considering how his coverage drops are creating opportunity otherwise for other players like Tavon Young, yeah, or Chuck Clark to blitz.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's not a real concern about his level of play. It's more a concern that someone might find a way to attack that weakness in the future. But I'm not, you know, the other thing that I didn't mention, which is a real positive for him in terms of in the run game. And actually we saw, I'm going to use an example from a pass rush snap, but I talked earlier about the importance of mental processing and deconstructing blocks, and his sack, the second sack, he reads the play. He knows what's coming. Like when you watch enough of the Broncos, like I did before the game, you know, you kind of can see what's coming. And he saw Tim Patrick coming on on the kickout block and got upfield in a hurry. And then Locke just couldn't get away from him. So he got that sack with his brain rather than with his feet. But obviously then deployed his feet very well, that he, the speed that he does have. But I felt like that is a way that he's going to be able to help himself in the future in terms of deconstructing blocks.
Right. I mean, it is Tim Patrick, so I don't want to overdo it, but Tim Patrick is 6'5" and has long arms, and that's a potentially difficult opponent for Bowser to get by. It's not like he's not pretty good at getting the body of a variety of taller tight ends and whatnot, but this is it's not a nothing block. I think it might be a harder block for him to defeat than even a running block, say.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. I want to talk about, let's talk about Justin Madubuike. And what I liked about, I mean, obviously lined up as a three tech in this game and primarily had Netani Moody in the game. He gave him fits in this. He had a sack, a quarterback hit. A sack was a thing of beauty in itself. And he also had one rep, at least against Quinn Miners, where he's three tech on the other side. And he not only bowled him for pressure, but then also got his hands up late to get the pass defense. So a great double on that play. I thought, again, you know, the Ravens have some finishers and they have some non-finishers in terms of their ability to complete sacks. But I thought the fact that he was able to take down Locke with using – it is Locke. Yeah, it was Locke, right?
Yeah.
With using just the shoulder pad was very impressive too.
Yeah. So with Madubuike, the thing I'm most impressed with first of all, the burst is mm-hmm. off the line is great for an interior player, but it's a lot of people don't, I think when a defensive lineman in terms of use of hands, that the hand usage needs to be, it's about leverage. It's about getting your hands on and locking out. And the guy just wins that battle all day long, especially in pass rush situations. And Netani Moody, watching him the snaps he's played the first three games, he's going to be a solid player in the league. And Madubuike just really did, like you say, he just ate his lunch most of the game. And so it was a really impressive performance from a pass rush perspective from Madubuike. The one thing, like I said earlier in the pod, was that, you know, I wonder if, currently his play against the run is hurting him in terms of his snap count. So I'd like to see some improvement there, but he can also be an utter wrecking ball against the run. And so I think the Ravens it's also beholden on the Ravens to utilize him better in their run defense as well.
meaning allow him to be the sort of penetrator that he is as a pass rusher against the run too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Who's your next player?
So I wanted to talk about Justin Houston, actually, because I think some of the stuff from Houston will have gone unnoticed for people. So we're all getting jumping up excited about the OA sack because it looked great and it was it was great. But one of the reasons why that sack happened was because Bridgewater couldn't step up because Houston had also won his rep. He'd come through his guy. I think it was Bowles, because I think it was that way around. I think he'd gone through Bowles and there was nowhere for Bridgewater to go. And I think this is the thing that he's not only is he obviously great at setting the edge and is an extremely physical run defender who plays with leverage. He's also just a professional pass rusher. And we're seeing, I think, you know, exactly what I thought we would get, which is just a very solid to good level of play each week out of Justin Houston. And it feels like Houston and Owe is a reasonably formidable combination. And I think the reason is because they work really well. They really complement each other very well. And we're going to see some more of those type of moves where Owe comes around the outside with a speed rush, knowing that they've planned it up together and that there'll be a pincer movement with Houston coming through a guy. So there's definitely that sort of, I'm excited about the combination of the two of them is why I wanted to bring up Houston.
Okay. So you're excited about those guys being on the field. It'd be mostly on a obvious passing down where they had three or more outside linebackers then, because Bowser's always on the field for those. Okay. So they could also do, I mean, this is one of the interesting things is they lost Daylon Hayes. They really need another guy who's a little bit reliable as a Sam linebacker. Owe is the obvious guy in terms of athleticism. It's you know, more duties to put on his plate, but he's learning things quickly. Is he a guy that you can line up on first and second down sometimes with Houston on the other side? They've already shown a kind of a predilection to having Houston be their guy on first down. I thought it would be McPhee, but it's really been more Houston than McPhee so far.
Yeah, I'm surprised at the lack of usage of McPhee. We don't need to get into it, but I am surprised that he was a guy that they were happy to cut and do the gentleman's agreement with to bring mm-hmm. back. I was surprised at that. So it is interesting that, but they, you know, the story about Houston and taking an awful lot less money than he could have done out there on the open market sort of tends to suggest that they do think really highly of him. So that's obviously why he's getting the reps. But I think that's a possibility. I think the worry for me is that you don't want to get into it. I'm not sure I want to get into too many situations where I'm taking away from rushing the passer. He is our weapon, and I want him to continue to develop that part of his game. And I'm you're right, he is picking up stuff quickly, and maybe you can start to get him to pick up even more stuff. But I feel like at the moment I would want him concentrated more on that play at the line of scrimmage a little more. So but if you want to get them both on the field at the same time, you've got to compromise somewhere. So
yeah. One thing they have an option to do is, okay, I mean, Owe would typically be a rush linebacker. I think we'd agree with this at this point in his career, not a Sam guy, but they just don't have anybody else. With Daylon Hayes out, there really isn't anybody else who's a legitimate Sam linebacker. McPhee wouldn't drop the coverage, neither would Houston, so neither would Ferguson. So all of those are kind of actually silly when you say them out loud. So it's either him or Hayes has to be the backup Sam. And right now Hayes is hurt. So you either have to play Bowser every single snap you might want that characteristic, or you have to have Owe taking it sometimes.
Yeah, and I'm a big Daylon Hayes guy, so it is a bit disappointing that we've lost him. But I think that was why I felt like that was actually a good pick. You know, a lot of people were sort of disappointed about the double dip at outside linebacker, but they're really they do feel like very different players. But I think you're right. Owe probably has the club in his bag and is definitely the guy who's the one that could do it. The other option, but I'm hesitant to do it because I think people don't. I'm hesitant to suggest it because people latch onto these kind of things, and I it's a big position. It would be a big position change, but Malik Harrison has the kind of the body type to do it. But I'm suggesting it because people will see it as an oversight if we didn't suggest it, but I'm not necessarily advocating it.
I got to hit you up with this now because they played Harrison effectively at outside linebacker two or three snaps in this game. But seeing what's happening with Queen and looking at the two of them and just seeing who's the better tackler, who makes more sense as a two down Mike, wouldn't a move to Mike be more normal?
I could not agree more with you. And I'm suggesting it because it's been suggested out there. I agree with you. I think he would be for me. I thought he had, maybe we'll touch on him. I thought he had a good game,
good game
this week.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I just felt like I think you're right. It's the tackling element to it. But I've banged on about this all podcast. It's the processing side of it. He reads things better than Queen right now. And so the thing you're taught. So I over the summer I did the Scouting Academy. And one of the key traits that we are taught to look for is play speed. And play speed is not how fast you run. It's how fast you run plus how quickly you process. And at the moment, Harrison has a quicker Harrison plays quicker than Queen currently. And it's because of it's because of the way he processes. And when he gets to when he gets there, I just feel much better about Harrison mauling a guy than I do Queen.
He's a better block shedder too. I mean, he has some natural talent at that, some real strength. He's the size you want in your two down thumper. There's just everything would make sense for it. And the Ravens, it was never going to happen before, but there are people this offseason talking about Queen getting the green dot someday. That ain't never happening. And you know what else? Harrison's never getting it either. Even if he ever becomes an every down linebacker, it's just too much of an asset to have the flexibility to take all your inside linebackers off the field that the Ravens would ever do it. But I like the idea. I really do like the idea of Malik moving to the mic. And what he did in this game, I thought he had a good game. First of all, he had a really good tackling game, I thought. Didn't have any misses as I scored it. He had that very nice play on the right sideline where he got off the block and made a tackle for, was that a loss of three or gain of three?
Either I think way, it was a gain of three, but it was, Yeah, I agree with you. And I felt that play is a really good microcosm of what you get from him. And then I think relatively quickly after, you also saw the other side of him that you would lose if you moved him to Sam, actually, is how well he takes on pullers. He is aggressive. He is consistent. And I love the way he does that. So, and that's what you, he's doing that because he's the Will currently. But, I do like that side of his game as well.
Wouldn't it be great though to have a Queen maybe be a trailing player? It just seems like all of the things that go with being a Will linebacker are more natural. Playing a gap behind, well, that'll give him that extra time maybe to make his read properly, or who knows. But it certainly creates more free run opportunities for him, I believe. Look, thinking back in Ravens history, Bart Scott was a guy, a little bit undersized, but very good at taking opportunities for free run. Of course, Bart Scott really did process very well. So it's probably not a fair comparison.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. So let's see. Any other players we want to hit on? I do want to hit on Anthony Averett before we move on, and then maybe we'll take some mailbag questions and name our MVPs here. Anthony Averett, I thought, had a terrific game. And it's true, he did give up that 32-yard throw, kind of a back shoulder quality to it. I don't know if you'd call it a back shoulder throw. Maybe you would. But he did a good job, I thought, after he got kind of shoved off on the play, still recovering, maintaining control, saving the touchdown by being able to make that tackle. Otherwise in the game, he was excellent in terms of coverage. He really didn't give up very much of anything. With the interception thrown in there, the quarterback rating throwing to his targets was 22.4 in this game. I had three completions on eight targets. So a very effective game for Averett. You mentioned the one thing on the run play. I don't disagree. He was kind of in a contained position there on Williams. He probably should have stuck his nose in there. Minor problem for me. When a cornerback doesn't play good run defense, I'll live with it.
Yeah, or maybe we're spoiled with Marlon Humphrey. but it was a minor thing. It wasn't me banging on the guy. I agree with you. I think he had a really great day in coverage. And like I said earlier, again, in a day that could have been a bit of a mismatch for him, he did a great job. And, you know, we're very lucky that we were able to keep him through a kind of tough period. It was obviously good that he was a draft pick, and so he was always probably going to stay on the roster. But you know, you have flashbacks to Darius Williams and losing him to the Rams, and you know, you wonder if we can keep these good corners on the roster that we seem to find so often, just for exactly the situation where there's an emergency. And I think we're very lucky that we've been able to keep Averitt on, let him develop, and get to this point now.
Yeah, I mean, he was a fairly high draft pick.
What,
he was fourth.
So yeah.
They weren't going to ever give up on him, I don't think. I mean, yep. I think of those guys like Shockey Brown and, you know, Warrior and Westry and guys that, you know, pick up from whatever secret sources they have, you know, to get a good player. Let's move to the mailbag here for a minute then. And before we do that, Averitt, would you sign him long term, or would you do it right now if you could?
I think that was a question in the mailbag, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I want to see a little bit more before I sign him long term. I want to see at least half a season. I think there was a bit of a debate when the question was submitted in the mailbag about about whether the Ravens should be signing him up on such a small sample size. And then someone came back and said, you do actually have to sometimes commit to players before they show it, because you get them at a bit of a discount. So right. Maybe we don't want to show the league and Averitt's agent another 4 or 5 games of good play. But I probably want to see just a little bit more of a sample size before I would commit. What would even at this point be pretty good money, I would think.
Well, I think that's really the question. At the beginning of this year, I think, you know, you might have had a player you could get for 3 years for $7.5 million, 3 years for maybe $6 to $9 million, let's say, or even, you know, a fairly broad range. And that would have given both sides something good. You know, obviously divisible benefit is there. He would get the income security for life, you know, that the players crave. He'd still be a free agent at, you know, a little bit older, obviously, but would at least have that option. And, you know, after watching what's happened to players like Matt Skura, like Brent Urban, in terms of, you know, their seasons not working out the way they'd hoped to in their contract years, you know, it can be very rough. It's a steep cliff to drop off. And I think there's more players than you think that are excited about trying to get those kind of contracts. I'm not sure the agents are. I think the players are more interested in taking them.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think that with the 4 games he's played already, that price has already gone up. I think from the 3 year, $7 million, yeah. I think it's gone up a decent amount already. I think, he's a guy that when you look at, put it this way, if they don't find a way to get him on a good deal, which is probably why the question is now whether he should be re-signed, if they don't find a way to get him on a good deal, I do think that becomes a pretty glaring need going into the next offseason.
Yeah, I mean, you'd be elevating Chris Westry, and you'd have to be finding the next Nigel Warrior after they've lost him, but... you know, they have a lot of older corners right now. You know, it's very possible Peters has played his last game. Marcus Peters has played his last game as a Raven. I think, you know, the odds are probably greater than 50%. That's true.
Yeah. And obviously without Peters, like you say, that room becomes Humphrey and Westry, and goes from what was a relative strength to an area of need pretty quickly.
Yeah. I guess we knew that was coming. And we also know, even though Tavon, I think, has played very well this year, you know, he's not going to be here next year at that contract number. So they're going to have to find some way to extend or renegotiate his deal for, you know, 2 to 3 more years, I would guess.
Yeah.
All right. Let's look at the mailbag. Obviously, you've had this up in front of you. So I'm going to alternate questions. And kind of the way we've been doing the last few weeks is just you pick a question you'd like and try and answer it. And then I might have something to say, or I might move on to the next question. But I'll go first. So first one is, I thought Owe had a better game than your comments. Would have had him 2 or 3 behind Bowser. What did he do wrong? Thank you. It wasn't what did he do wrong. This game, if you scored it notes wise, was just a highlight reel for the Ravens pass rush players. I mean, they're all putting in place. I kept Campbell you know, out of my top three. And I think I felt bad doing it, but I did it because he's been in there the last few weeks and I wanted to have star treatment on some other player. But Owe had a fine game. No objection here.
Yeah, should I? I'll go on to the next one. Is it me or is it uncommon to have such a healthy mix of vet and young players as stars every week on defense? Seems like in the past we were more reliant on older vets, but now lots of young guys stepping up. Mad, Owe, Bowser, Averett, with mid and older guys. I don't think it's necessarily uncommon. I think it's a good thing. It's something that, as Jeff, who made the question, points out, there are, you know, we've had a long time here in Baltimore where we've had older players holding it up and older players on long-term contracts. There's a reality to the fact that we are about to enter a Joe Flacco second contract era, yeah, in terms of paying generational wealth to a quarterback, where we are going to have to get some contributions from some frankly cheaper players, which is an awful way to look at it, but it is a business, and so we do need some of those younger players to step up who are early on in their rookie contracts is the other thing. You know, we need Dalen Hayes to be good when he comes back. Some of those guys this draft class, they need to get three or four hits at least out of this latest class. So I do think it's a good thing that there's a mix of youth and veterans there, and they're good veterans is the other thing. I that's the other thing I would point out. I think
the offensive side, I mean, they've had this benefit now for a number of years since the 18 draft, really, and having young players like Hurst and Brown, and you know, they only really had started off with one expensive guy. Stanley was still on his rookie deal, and the only expensive guy on the whole offense was Yanda, maybe Boyle to a lesser degree, but you know, you have Andrews and you have Marquise Brown. I mean, they have all the running backs they've had. It's just been a historically efficient offense relative to cap. That's going to change, as you mentioned, and the players that will have to get younger are definitely on defense. We've done a number of pods over the off season in terms of how cap's going to have to shift, and you know, you have to start with probably players like Campbell and Brandon Williams and Peters perhaps being in their last year with the Ravens to be able to afford Jackson's contract. All right, I'll go into another question. Can you discuss each inside linebacker? No, we're not going to do that. And progress from last year. But I do want to talk about one because we didn't really talk about Chris Board much. Chris Board, prior to 2021-20, had been a good tackler. And he'd been a real good tackler on special teams, that's been shown. And this year, he's been a good tackler again. He really hasn't missed a bunch of tackles. I thought he played pretty well in this last game. And he made six or seven tackles to lead the team, whatever it was. I think, you know, I still am not real sanguine about his coverage ability. I'm not happy about his ability to look between level two and three. I'm really not even happy for his ability to process quickly to get downhill to the right spot on a running back. But I think the fact that he's been making tackles when he gets there is a significant improvement from last year.
Yeah, I would completely endorse what you just said. I think he is now an intriguing option at inside linebacker. I would expect to see his snap count rise somewhat over the next couple of games. If nothing more than to do what you said earlier, which was to maybe put Queen in some more advantageous positions than they have done so far. So we've got Stevens and Elliott, one game only with Stevens starting. How much did we lose for not having Elliott? How far is Stevens from being starting caliber player? And of course, implications on Elliott's extension. So I think we did lose a significant amount from not having Elliott in this game. I think the main thing we lost was Elliott's click and close ability from the back end. I feel like Elliott is a bit of a weapon that they can use as well on the blitz. I think that we saw flashes from Brandon Stevens, from Stevens, and I do think that he is going. I do think he's going to be a good player. I think we have got a good one there, but I think we're seeing normal growing pains with him in terms of his in terms of the fact that, especially that he's a convert from running back into an extremely weird defense at SMU as a corner, and now coming into the league as a kind of all around versatile defensive back. So definitely got to give him quite a bit of a pass on some of the areas for development in his game. But I think we missed quite a bit from Elliott, and I think with Stevens is a is a long way from being Elliott's caliber of player at this point.
Yeah, it does bring up an interesting point in terms of extension, because Stevens, I think the area where I'm most concerned about him right now, because I think he's going to get the coverage elements correct, I think I'm most concerned about him as a tackler. And having him specifically as the last line of defense, as the free safety, is a little bit scary right now. He's had some problems, obviously, with that. You know, I think the thing I like about him better than I like about Elliott is something we've mentioned on this show before, is that he and Stone both have an ability to lay off a hit when they're behind a receiver. It's more of a read-esque quality. Now, Stone really has it in spades, but to a lesser degree, I think Stevens has it, whereas Elliott is a closer and a finisher. So you show him the meat, he's going right for it in terms of that tackle. And it really means what he's going for is a pass defense to knock that ball loose, as opposed to picking up an interception, which obviously has a lot higher value. And you know, you want safeties that are competent in making the judgment between those two things. So while I really love Elliott as a player, that's one area where I wish he'd get better. Okay, let's go with one more if we got it. How many hours does James have in the day? It comes from your friend at UK.
I have a job too, so.
you do. What do you do for a living, James?
I work in operations for a big education charity here in the UK. So it's a busy job. So I have to find time to carve out lots of time to be able to do this stuff. I'm up pretty late a lot of nights.
That's everybody who does this makes that sacrifice for some time, and then hopefully you get to retire at some point and do this full time, James, because you got a real knack for it. Well, I got one more here. Are they overusing Campbell? Had so many snaps versus Detroit, I thought they'd give him a break with two starters back. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think, like you pointed out earlier in the pod, he's used to playing long stretches of a lot of snaps. I think the thing that people miss, given that I think Ravens fans often sometimes, well, casual Ravens fans won't know the kind of history of players, and Clayus Campbell, it was, you know, a model of consistency in terms of being on the field, of his availability throughout his career. I went back and looked, and I think he missed very few games over the last 5-6 years before he joined the Ravens. So there's not necessarily a durability concern. Like you say, there is a potential that, you know, he is getting up there in age, and we don't want him playing tons and tons of snaps. But I don't think the level that the Ravens have him playing at the moment, even in these games, is hugely concerning to me. It's not like a situation that I felt that they had last year, where I felt they were overusing Wolf given his injury history.
Oh, yeah.
It's not that kind of situation to me. I think we're fine. I'd like to see, you know, I'd like to see him get a bit lesser snap count as we start to get into the meat of the season, but I'm not overly concerned.
Yeah. What I'd like to see is the Ravens have a few more leads where they can afford to take some players off the field. And one of the nice things, and I think we're really indicative, was they got Tavon off the field at the end of the Scots game. And that's really, I think, showing a good, I mean, not like they would not know this, but it's showing a good understanding of which players are really important to reduce snap count. And you have to put 11 out there every play. It's just, that's the way the game is played. So you better have a willingness to figure out who that is you want to put out there. Defensive MVPs, do you care to do this with me?
Yeah, I probably tipped my hat earlier in the pod. I Chuck Clark would be my defensive MVP for this game. He gets taken for granted sometimes, and I just felt like he was all over the field in this game, and used his particular skills to be able to really affect the game, and was a big part of the reason why the defense was so dominant.
Okay, I can't object to that. I wouldn't have objected if you had said Calais Campbell either, who I left off and felt bad about it. My number three guy, Justin Madubuike, very low total snap count, very impressive number of pass rush events. Anthony Averett's my number two guy, extraordinary job of holding down the right cornerback position. And Tyus Bowser's my number one guy, who just he had a wonderful game of pass rush events given his relatively limited number as well. James, thanks for coming on. First of all, it's great to talk football with you. It's an hour and 17 minutes, and it just feels like we just started. I love this conversation. Really appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, ditto, Ken. It was great fun to talk to you. And like I said, yeah, it's 20 past 11 here at night, and I could go on into the early hours.
All right. Tell people again where they can find you on Twitter and where they can find your work.
Yeah, so my Twitter handle is at NFL Ogden, so you can find me on Twitter there. I write on my own website, which is redstarbaltimore.com. There's less up there recently because I also write for russellstreetreport.com, and I write the weekly Battle Plans piece. You can also hear me on the UK Ravens podcast, which comes out every Thursday, and me and Dev Panchwar also do a podcast where we talk about the upcoming game and look sort of in more depth at my Battle Plans piece, and you get to hear Dev's great insights too, as well as mine. So that's great. So you can find me on all those places.
Okay. Really, really enjoyed Dev, of course, longtime friend of the show, and I've known him for probably 15 years at this point. If you're looking to do a pod with me, we have an opportunity. We're looking back at 25 years of Ravens history and trying to get people interested in taking some very specific focused point. Again, we're not looking to do the Mount Rushmore of Ravens. We're not looking to do your top 10 Ravens of all times. Those topics have been discussed to death. We're looking for discussion of somebody who wants to discuss Corey Ivey or what happened to Jared Gaither and how he self-destructed. Or you want to go back earlier into backup quarterbacks for the Ravens and talk about this. All of those topics are of interest to me. We've had a lot of people talk about individual games. That's cool as well. Whatever you'd like to do, we're interested in those kind of offbeat historical pods that you would never otherwise hear about this thing and have it discussed. Give me a DM. We'll hammer out a topic. If I think what you've got is a little bit too broad, which is usually the case, then we'll narrow that down and talk about some specific things. But really appreciate you coming on, James.
Thanks, Ken. Anytime.
We'll talk to you next time on Film Study.